Hi everyone, my name's PK and here I'm very grateful to have James Kirby on. For those of you who don't know, I'm sure many of you do know him, but for those of you who don't know, he's a wealth editor at The Australian. He's one of Australia's most experienced, like more wealth and finance orientated journalists. He's a former managing editor and co-founder of The Business Spectator and Eureka Report, and also has previously worked at The Australian Financial Review and South China Morning Post. He's on TV and radio a lot, and he's also the author of several biographies. And right now he hosts a pretty terrific, I should say, podcast called The Money Puzzle Podcast. Go check it out. I listen to that from time to time myself. James, thank you so much for making time. Very grateful.
Thank you, PK. Delighted to be on the show, and good for you for building what you've built out there.
I appreciate it. And just for everyone's sort of background, you know, I first started listening to James, I think it must have been like, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago. There was a different podcast he used to be on, and I just thought, you know, what he brought to the finance or the wealth world was someone who is obviously not in their 20s, like that's fine, but it was still so down to earth and so relatable. And I was in my 20s at that time, and I was like, yeah, I kind of resonate with this guy. So I have a lot of respect for you, James, and what you're doing, and hopefully we can bring a lot of value to my audience today. Welcome to the Oz Property Investment Mastery Podcast. My name's PK and I help busy people build passive income by buying top 5% growth and cash flow property and build a portfolio using data without wasting months doing research, spending weekends at inspection or catching flights, or dropping $10,000 to $20,000 on buyer's agents every single time. So if you're confused, lack confidence, and just overwhelmed with all the information and marketing misinformation available online and don't know where to start, then this show is for you. All right, so I think what we could just a bit of an agenda for everyone who's listening. We're probably going to riff on this episode, but I thought we could talk sort of global economy, chances of recessions, hard landing, soft landing, kind of then come into the Australian context. And obviously, James loves to talk about the housing market and things like that. So we could kind of finish off on forecasts or outlooks, at least on Aussie housing. But I guess the first question I had for you, James, is like, you know, you're a wealth editor and you have been and you've been kind of in this industry as an observer for a long time. What does a wealth editor do, just for my audience? And you know, do you have access to, or you obviously have access to so many industry professionals. Do you feel you have a leg up when it comes to investing for yourself?
Well, it's just funny you mentioned that, because I've just been, it's that time of the year where you review your self-managed super fund. Yeah. Certainly I do. I always make myself, I get the accounts in by Christmas. That's my golden rule. And so I just got my audited accounts back and everything, where you sort of have that nail-biting moment where you say, okay, well, I've done my calculations and I reckon my fund did this and this and this, but let's see what the auditor actually signs off. And let's see what came out the other end of the process when it's actually formally done in the accounts. And look, it's fine. I'm very happy with it once again. But it does. I've always run my own SMSF, and I do it because I think, as a wealth editor, as a financial journalist, that I think you should walk the talk. And I'm always. I've done a lot of things over the years, including being involved in a startup company, which we started, you know, with just four people, and it was 50 people when we sold it 8 years later. And so I've actually been in business, and I've always run my own money and I feel that that's important, because that's exactly the people who are listening to you. That's who they are. And so in many ways, I'm informed by my own world. It's not just theoretical. Like I really, right. You know, if someone says to me, you should be in whatever they say, you should be in overseas stocks more than you are in ASX stocks, or you know, you should buy in Perth this year because Perth is going to blow out the lights because it's got to catch up with the rest of the country as a property investor. These aren't just sort of passing fancies with me. This is really my, this is my world. This is my own money, which I'm, which is on the table. And I think it gives you, if nothing else, it gives, it makes you alert, PK. You really mean it when you say such and such is a good idea, or such and such is a bad idea. Yeah.
No, I always thought that journalists, you know, you have access to so many leading minds, and it's a fantastic place to be just in terms of your own intelligence and knowledge level. And
well, yeah, the access is the for me, on a, being on the national title and being around for decades, thankfully, it is the case, but only in recent, I feel like it's only recent times, but certainly in the last decade or so, I can get just about anybody I want. If I, you know, I can cold call them and say, I want to talk to you about X or Y. And generally, 99 times out of 100, that person will come back. And that is a privilege. I do appreciate it. And also, I would say that when I am putting something in print or even doing the podcast, I always do check. It's not just my notions. Again, it's not just me saying whatever I might be looking at or working on. I would always make sure that I talk to people in that are there or that I'm talking about, because I want to know what they have to say. And sometimes it just confirms what you think, but sometimes it completely throws you and you're saying, oh gosh, actually, you know, I'm on the wrong track here. The facts are different. So that's the great advantage, I think, of staying, working as a daily journalist, that you actually are at the coalface, you know.
That's a great advantage. And, you know, with respect to, I mean, if we zoom right out to the macro in terms of the global economy, let's say the US specifically, you know, I don't think many people, correct me if I'm wrong here, James, had anticipated where we would be exactly here in 2024 with rates the way they are now. Certainly there's, I feel, a in the media and in other places as well amongst economists, there's a certain sense of pessimism about the ability for the Fed to navigate a soft landing. I mean, it's seldom happened in the past. If you look at me, I mean, I don't have decades of experience like you, but at least if you understand, you know, if I look at the data myself, I'm thinking, hey, there's actually a real good chance that this might be the one time, you know, the interest rate cycle finishes and they start cutting and actually the US doesn't go into a deep recession. And that's not really happened that much, that often before
that's right.
Or after.
I mean, that's right. Historically, the odds are against it. But as we speak, in mid-January, it would seem that that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always think the market never lies. And if you look at what's happening just now on global markets and even our own ASX, there's been a couple of good weeks. And that is largely on the back of that sense that, yes, it's going to be a soft landing. It can happen. And it looks just now quite likely that that's the case, which is a good thing. It doesn't mean, by the way, that everything's easy. And the US and the US stock market completely and utterly dictate the immediate tempo of the Australian stock market. By that, I mean, if you get up in the morning and Wall Street was good last night, the ASX will be good today and vice versa. But after that, there is a separation on a more serious base or on a more serious setting. And we've got really particular issues here. Nothing wrong with unemployment. Hey, it's 3.9. That's fine. But the economy is barely ticking along. Expected to grow at 1%. Last year it was 2%. So that's slow. Okay. So it's a full employment economy, but it's like barely ticking along. And we have inflation, which is probably sitting at about 5%. So if you're an investor and you're a property investor, and all the leading lights in property who, by the way, have a very poor record of forecasting properly. But anyway, they all say, more or less, the consensus this year, calendar 2024, would appear to be that property will do something in the order of 3 to 5% this year. Well, the way I would look at it, PK, is it better? Because inflation is 5%. Mm-hmm. So really, your property in real terms, if you owned a property, is going nowhere if it did 5% and inflation was 5%. Mm-hmm. And that's what most of us depend on, the capital appreciation. It's not like we're in it for the running yield. It's not like we're in it for income. Because if you are in it for income, again, I know there are exceptions to this, but numerically, most people, most of the time, have the properties in the larger cities. And the yields in the larger cities are certainly so low that, and assuming you're geared against it, you're really hoping for capital price appreciation. And that's great. And you get 5%, that's great. But it's a bit of a downer when you find out that inflation was 5%.
Yeah.
And you, in real terms, actually didn't make any money. That's what I worry about. I think that's the real concern this year. That's the challenge this year, to genuinely make anything out of property when you allow for how low income is in real terms, especially if you're geared and rates are 6% and 7%, and how low capital appreciation is in real terms if you allow for inflation. That, you know, I'm just a devil's advocate there, because you might have
I think this is a... See, this is the reason I think it's great to have folks like you on, because I think there's a broader perspective that you bring to just property. I think, you know, if you ask a property, you know, through and through sort of person, they'll say, oh, look, James, that's all good and well, but we know how little supply is coming onto the market. I mean, we can... Perth, I think rental properties, the number of rental properties is down 3 years, as in it's gone from 220 properties to 200 rental stock. So that's pretty significant. And they can list a bunch of statistics to say, look, property is going to do really well. And I think there's a real disconnect, and I'm not saying who's correct or wrong, between the sort of property aficionado and connoisseur versus those sort of bank economists who I think people have become a little bit skeptical of, because, you know, they tend to be incorrect. But I think that's my sort of question to you. On boots on the ground, you know, on the coalface, I would probably say, hey, look, James, you're probably right, national level, you know, 3 to 5%, something like that, mostly driven by Melbourne and Sydney, which is, you know, where the weighting goes towards, but places like Brisbane, Perth, maybe not so Adelaide at the peak end of its cycle, but certainly Perth and Brisbane, some regional Queensland areas, wouldn't be surprised if they grow double digits. Now, of course, I'm a property guy. There's probably some bias and confirmation bias in there. But how do you sort of, you know, reconcile that versus maybe folks like you, or maybe not like you, but more like economists and et cetera, financial advisors sort of saying, look, it's a tough time for property, because they've sort of said that for many years and it didn't end up being a tough time.
They have. That's right. Well, there's pros and cons. As you say, the property expert on the ground, the person who really knows property, they really know property. But the problem talking to them is that they are mindlessly optimistic about property.
That I agree.
And in a way, they must be right, because they're selling it 9 times out of 10. The people at the other end, the bank economists, et cetera, they stand back and they say, they make those arguments like I was making. Oh, look, there's inflation at 5%, and if it grows 5%, you're going nowhere. But there's two things. First is, so what I try and do is I basically try and synthesize them all, blend them all, and say, well, you know, what should we really look for? Two things. All property is long-term. It's really long-term, right? And the long-term figures are very convincing. In some ways, the wind is behind property developers and property investors in one hugely important way, which is supply. Okay, there's very little supply. And 500,000 people came into the country last year on top of a fairly tight market. So whatever else that means, it means that don't have to worry about demand, right? You really don't have to worry. If you own something, you're going to rent it. You can rent anything in this market, it seems to me, anything. And the third point is that the property market, it has some particular advantages. And one is all property is local. So you said to me just then, some region might go up 10%. I don't doubt that for a moment. And I don't doubt for a moment that you could show me 100 property investors in Melbourne this year, and 10 of them could do really, really well. And it doesn't matter if the city went nowhere, because all property is local. That's not something which strikes me. One of the things, doing a podcast on property and doing a second podcast on the wider investment market, it does strike me regularly that the great thing about property is you have so much control. Like, if I go and buy an index fund on the American stock market, that's all fine. And by the way, it's no work, right? I never have to think about it again. It's the easiest thing in the world. I put it in a drawer and forget about it for the year. And I have zero influence on that. If I buy a property, I have enormous influence on which one I buy, which is so, so important. And on top of that, I can improve that property. I can improve that asset and make it more attractive. I can't do that. I don't think I can do that with any other asset, PK. If you could think of one, let me know what it is.
No. You're 100% right. And I think what I wanted to ask you, and I think my audience asks me all the time, and I can't say I'm a practicing economist, but I think it'd be good to get your perspective. You know, obviously, if you take two lines and you put wage growth in Australia and you put property or house prices, the two lines are decoupled. They have been for many decades. Obviously, there's some reasons you can explain that LVR positions increase, you know, fairer sex went to work, et cetera, things like that. But from your perspectives, you know, very experienced, do you think, I mean, in the 90s, people were saying property is unaffordable, early 2000s, 2010s, there's still a problem. When does the problem boil over? And I just want to preface hopefully your answer. My hypothesis is that ever since, you know, we sort of started leveraging currency, fiat currency, 70s, we started living in this debt-fueled world. You know, the currency has been debased, inflation is gone up and down, mostly up, and real assets have gone up a lot. When I look at the price of property and I compare it to gold, compared to gold, it hasn't gone up that much, but compared to Australian dollars or US dollars, it has gone up. So is property affordable? I think one answer is yes, if you compare it to gold, but obviously for the layman, it's not affordable. But do you think there's a tipping point? I mean, we're this capitalism system, the fiat currency system, that's not going away. Our sort of, you know, political leaning, capitalistic sort of Australian economy is not going away. Do you think we'll still be complaining about house prices not being affordable in the 30s, 40s, 50s? Or do you think there is genuinely a tipping point at which, assuming no crazy immigration, assuming no crazy like Chinese money coming in, Indian money coming in, do you think there's a tipping point at which the property market does start to, I don't want to use the word crash, but hey, it's no longer feasible to invest in real estate?
I don't think there's a risk of crash, but I think there's probably a risk of a period of drift where we do 3-5% every year. And inflation is 3-5% every year. And in fact, nothing's happening. Mm. And you're getting a situation, something like Japan. I don't know if we've reached that, though. This thing about property being unaffordable, it wasn't always the case, actually. It was more a regional conversation, invariably Sydney. And that has really become front and center most recently. There was an extraordinary table in the Australian during the week, which was so extraordinary, PK. I had to ring, even though I should believe my own paper, I had to ring and see if it was correct. So the point was that mortgage stress, right, is defined as more than 30% of your household income going to your mortgage. And so they did the numbers on this. And what they did was they looked at the median house price in Sydney and all the other cities. And then they looked at how much that would cost on your mortgage. So the median for the person who had the median house with an ordinary mortgage, how much they pay per month, and then how much you would have to make to not be in mortgage stress.
Right.
Okay. So we take it that the Sydney house price is $1 million, the Melbourne house price is 750, and then these people are paying so many thousands per month on their mortgages. And the figures were, the end figures were, that a family in Sydney, this is household income, right? So everybody, not just one person, household income to not be in mortgage stress in Sydney was 200,000 after tax. I saw the words after tax and I said, that can't be right. And I actually rang the people behind the report and I said, have we got it right? I'm sure the reporter who did this story would kill me if they thought another reporter was ringing saying, have we got it right? But I was talking to them about something else, and we just, and the researcher said, oh no, I don't think so. Yeah, that might be wrong, all right. And then they went back and they went, no, actually, sorry, James, that's right, after tax. Then I said, hang on a second, are you telling me that unless you make more than $200,000 a year after tax, you're in mortgage stress? And they said, that's the case. Well, here's the thing. Basically, mortgage stress is a nonsense figure at this stage, because everybody must be in mortgage stress, because the percentage of people who are making $200,000 after tax in Sydney per year is very small. The figure for Melbourne is 150 ditto. The point I'm making is, number one, it is extremely expensive and a very I don't want to say unaffordable, because it's a slippery term. How far will people go? That's the real question. How far will they go? Because as you're alluding to, if they don't keep going, then the whole thing unravels, right? So if people say, no, I won't do it, I will never buy a home, and people stop buying, then the demand soaks away and the market does fall. I don't think we've reached that point yet. I don't know where that point is. But I tell you one thing, that even the definitions of mortgage stress are out of date at this stage.
Yeah.
I mean, 30% of household income, nonsense. People are spending 30, 40, 50% of their household income to pay those mortgages. That's the first thing. The second thing is that people are doing things we would never have thought they would do to get a house, whatever it takes. And that includes pre-spending their inheritance or whatever, or their parents effectively helping them out. And that's all fine, that they don't inherit anything later in life. But we haven't reached that point where it's impossible yet. I hate to say it, but we haven't. And on that basis, it will keep going. The other thing is, how valuable is a home? I always distinguish homes from properties. How much is it worth to have a house? How much is it worth to have a home? We thought it was worth X, and then there was the pandemic, and we realized it was X plus whatever, 50%, because where you were in the pandemic really, really mattered, because you were stuck there.
Yeah. These are really interesting thoughts. I mean, the definition of mortgage stress, 30%, like you said, even rental stress, I think all of the major cities in Australia are well beyond 30, except for perhaps Perth, which is just around 30. So those definitions have gone out the drain. And I think I was speaking with a few demographers. I don't want to put any words in their mouth, but they were sort of opining that potentially the wealth distribution in Australia in 2024 is no longer like a normal distribution curve, but rather it's skewed to the left and skewed to the right. And so, yes, there's a lot of people struggling in the left and the middle, but the middle class is vanishing. And even though the average person can't afford the average house, there's enough people on the right, enough wealthier people, whether local or abroad, that can. And so obviously that's not a good thing. But do you think that's the case, or do you think the wealth distribution hasn't really changed in the last couple of decades?
Oh no, it's changed enormously, and the home ownership figures are dropping like a stone. So that's the main change. It really is. And then we get onto the whole issue of tax and etc. But you know, one of the things that you found, whatever, there is this all these things they won't touch. So they won't touch negative gearing, they won't touch capital gains tax discounts, they won't touch the accessibility to the pension. So you can have a house worth $10 million and you can wander down the road and get a government pension at the moment. And they won't touch any of that stuff. So they kind of fiddle, tinker around the edges with the tax system. But yeah. Unfortunately, our tax system absolutely accelerated house prices and rewarded everybody for buying a home, which sounded good at the time.
Yeah.
30 years later, we're in this very difficult position where the homes are so expensive, which is no compensation for homeowners, but for property investors, which is obviously what we're talking about here. I think the opportunity remains. I think the average house price will continue to rise, and I think there's probably terrific opportunities in spots always, especially if you're prepared to go interstate, like we talk about PERF. It's got years of catching up to do.
Yeah. No, but I like your point around mortgage stress. I do think I agree with some of the major cities. Perhaps Melbourne has some value in it, given it's really underperformed since COVID. But Sydney, it's due time for a drift period. I mean, the last decade, it outperformed everywhere else. And if you look at the data, I'm sure you well know this, James, that you can't continue outperforming. One city can't continue outperforming forever. I mean, in the early 2000s to about 2012, Sydney was by and large flat. So I don't think it'll be flat, but I think your point is true. There is an impending drift period for some cities. And I know you have to go soon. I just want to sneak in one last question, if I may. And this is perhaps more of a political one and to do with negative gearing. Obviously, everyone knows Labor potentially lost the election two elections ago. Maybe it was because negative gearing or a combination of a few different things, capital gains and franking credits, etc. Do you think, I mean, there's just been some murmurs of it in the last week again. Is there enough social or rather political capital for them to go there or not at this election?
There is enough. And I, this is why. The government, that is the Albanese government, has commenced a political approach in measured and careful steps, which they are having success with. The first one, so what you do is you, as you say, Bill Shorten ALP did not get elected. And there's many reasons why. And I haven't seen a comprehensive analysis as to which one it was. They're all relevant, right? But when they got in first, the first thing they did, which was almost like a mini experiment, was they isolated the wealthiest superannuants, and they effectively doubled the tax on super over 3 million. It's a high number. It's a small number. It's the wealthiest people in the country. No one's going to march in the streets for them. And that goes through. Emboldened, if you like, by that and by the success of that, they've now moved a step higher, a much, much bigger move. But it's a similar theme. You look at the numbers, you isolate the highest, the wealthiest people in the country. And in this case, it was earners. On 200,000 plus, and you say, actually, you were going to get a tax cut that was worth about 9,000 to you, and we're cutting it in half. And we're redistributing that money to the 61% of taxpayers who will get more than they thought. Electorally, that's probably going to work as well. Mm-hmm. And it's probably going to go through Parliament. And so you sit back and you say, well, those two worked. What else could we do? And where else could we do that again? How would we do that again? Well, let's have a look at negative gearing. All you got to do is put a limit on it. So you say, there are people who have 7 properties that are negatively geared. You cap it. And again, what you're doing is you're capturing the those people, not everybody with seven negatively geared properties is wealthy.
Yeah, definitely not.
They're probably trying to be, that's for sure. Yeah. And they're probably stretching themselves to the limit to be. However, I think that they will find a way again to isolate a group that's the wealthiest group or seem to be the wealthiest group, and then move in on that. Yeah. I don't know whether it will be the capital gains discount or negative gearing. I have a theory, PK, which is that politicians will actually always do the one that is hardest to understand, because people then can't follow it. A very successful sort of way of pulling back some money a few years ago was when they changed the taper arrangements on pension access. The taper arrangements on pension access are very difficult to explain. Most people don't know what it is, don't know how it works. It's a great way to save money. Every time in the budget, you go to the budget every year, you find that there's these little, small, little, difficult to understand changes, and they bring in huge savings. And I think perhaps they'll do something similar again. So maybe it'll be negative gearing, maybe it'll be capital gains tax discount, whichever one is the most difficult for the wider public to understand. That's the one they'll go for, as long as they can isolate the wealthiest people in society. And it works. Yeah. It works. I mean, I think that the downside of it is that there is no pretense any longer that everyone's included. But I do think when being around long enough, the Hawke and Keating ALP administration, there was very bold reforms, and they were going to make it better for everybody. These reforms from this ALP administration are very selective. And I think the formula is in place now, and I think the formula will be extended again. And I do think the obvious area is property investment rewards, if you like. And there's two ways you're rewarded. One is negative gearing, one is capital gains tax discount. It'll be one of those two.
Yeah. Thank you for those thoughts. It's one thing's for sure. Like you said, it will be a complicated thing for the average person or the average person who would complain to understand, but it would be a very simple thing to advertise and get a lot of votes for. So I think it's good to hear your thoughts on it. Maybe we have to do another session down the line on how it actually impacted property prices the last time it happened, because I don't think it necessarily crashed the market, and we'll have to see how it impacts the housing supply over the long term, because obviously investors play a crucial role. But there is something to be said about fairness in the housing market, and it has, I think, in some parts of Australia at least, gotten out of hand. But I think we'll probably wrap it up there. I could go on and on, but I know you're a busy man, James. Or anything?
We'll talk again, PK. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, anything you'd like to say before we finish it off?
One thing about negative gearing, the most I suppose, adventurous, combative, and successful treasurer, among them at least, was Paul Keating. And he actually was the one who tried to reverse negative gearing, and he couldn't do it. So it would be interesting to see if anyone can do it.
Yeah, let's see. And if it does go by the wayside, and then the LNP come back in power in the future, whether they repeal it, it's all very
it's all to play for.
Well, thank you very much, James. Could you just give a shout out for the two podcasts that you do so people can find you?
Of course. It's the Money Puzzle podcast. It's available everywhere, and we do a property podcast on Tuesdays, and we do wider all investment issues on Thursdays, and a future guest is PK.
Thank you very much. Thank you. James Covey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, James, and thank you, everyone. Cheers.
Thanks, PK.